Government of Canada.
Knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT, stay tuned.
You're tuned in to Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It is Wednesday, the 27th of January. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thanks for being with us. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on CKUT People Powered Radio. Today on the show, it is January 2021, and I wanted to look back at January 2002. In New York City, there was a very important protest against the World Economic Forum, and I wanted to highlight that because it was an important convergence where economic inequality and war were being protested in common. The World Economic Forum, of course, usually takes place in Davos, Switzerland, and it is a gathering of the economic elites of the world. It is closed doors. It is very expensive, not accessible, but very influential on economic and social policy globally. In 2001, then Mayor Michael Bloomberg, well, actually in early 2002, announced that the World Economic Forum would be coming to New York City. This was just months after 9/11. There was a huge mobilization to protest, and it was both a mobilization to protest global economic inequality, but also to protest war. I remember one of the banners, I did join the protests at the time in New York. One of the banners read, "Our grief is not a cry for war." And I thought that that was very powerful. I wanted to talk with Eric Larson about this protest, but also about the abilities of social movements to look critically at the issues of our time, to look at the intersections between economic, social injustice. It's a perspective, I think, that street mobilizations for equality, for global justice, really did bring to the table. And I think a perspective of intersectional analysis about global politics, about global economics, that is really important to consider at this time of pandemic. So here's an excerpt of my conversation with writer Eric Larson, who is one of the spokespeople of the mobilization in New York City against the World Economic Forum, the mass protests. There were tens of thousands of people who participated. And I called Eric recently. Here's an excerpt of our exchange.
It was just literally months after 9/11. The whole country was in shock. We were in shock as a movement because an awful lot of our energy up to that point had been deployed around globalization, corporate globalization, and the impact of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the global banking establishment, multinational lenders, and the impact they were having on economies around the world. I mean, not just the developing world and the developed world. And this was, you know, and 9/11 comes along and it changes the subject immediately. And as I remember, the protest actually, the planning actually started earlier, at least in kind of an embryonic way, because we knew that there was an invasion of, you know, an invasion of Afghanistan happened. Invasion of Iraq was the Bush administration. All of a sudden, invasion of Afghanistan was contemplated, and the, you know, the war drums were beating, and so we wanted to have a large protest demo in New York to basically, because we thought it was very important to say New York does not support this. You know, we're the city that was hit by this horrible attack. We don't support going to war. Okay, so we began to think about some kind of a large event. We were having small events quite a bit, like increasingly at the UN and elsewhere, but we thought about doing something large. All of a sudden, one day, we get the news that the World Economic Forum was going to have Instead of having its Davos meeting in Switzerland at this big ski resort, it was going to do it in New York as a kind of a solidarity gesture with the people of New York and with Wall Street. And I remember literally being at a Direct Action Network meeting and somebody saying this, and it was several of us chiming in all of a sudden, you got to be kidding. They're going to do this. They're going to turn New York City, which has been, you know, devastated, into a kind of a capitalist love fest. And we thought, well, we have to build it around this. We have to do it. It's a little off the subject, but we have to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it gets to the resources we had. When I think back on it, tremendous resources and abilities for doing something like that back then. We had the Direct Action Network. We had a lot of organized labor was on our side, as a result of the Seattle battle in Seattle, a lot of monitoring. There was a lot of careful monitoring of what these international institutions were doing. There had been big protests in Davos the last several years against the World Economic Forum meeting, because it was considered to be kind of like an epicenter, major event of the year for the advocates of corporate globalization. And so that was something that was a focal point for us. So we were able to kind of turn on a dime in terms of research and getting our messaging together and so forth, because we'd been focusing on what these people had been doing for so long. There was Direct Action Network. Convergence Against Capitalism. ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I mean, and in so many ways, I mean, we are in a moment of crisis. It's January 2021, and we see the ways that points of crisis disproportionately impact people based on class, based on race, based on location. And there's such an important, I think, mainstreaming of analysis around the ways that inequality is shaped by structural injustice, which is a good thing. And I think there has been an advance in popular understanding around those structural inequalities, which I think connecting that to histories of struggle is really important. So in regards to the World Economic Forum in New York City, I think 9/11 has become such an important reference point and continues to be. And I'm referencing that in terms of the way that 9/11 impacted New York. I mean, of course, you're a New Yorker, and that's how I know you, is from activism there. So I just wanted to highlight the ways that post 9/11 New York, and I remember speaking with you then in the fall, actually, and thinking about the ways that different communities were responding to a crisis. And I'm underlining crisis here because of the crisis we're in now. It's not the same crisis, but I think thinking critically about crises and how they manifest is important today. But I remember, for example, the ways that communities of migrant workers who were impacted by 9/11, especially window washers. There was that company Windows on the World, I remember.
Yes.
And there was quite a few services for working class migrants who were actually the ones tasked with cleaning the windows of the financial sector. And their office check-in point was in one of the two World Trade Center buildings. And their check-in point, I remember, was in the morning. So everybody would go there to get their schedule and then go to clean around. Maybe I'm missing a few details, but something like that. Remember the Frank Morales explaining that to me, a community activist in New York.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But just to think about, you know, the ways, and you talked about the World Economic Forum that Bloomberg had decided to bring in as sort of a spaceship, and, you know, a class of people that were not impacted in the same way by 9/11 and its consequences. So thinking about how crisis disproportionately impacts people, I don't know if you have any reflections on the moment we're talking about, January 2002, and thank you for clarifying that, and what's happening now and the ways that crises disproportionately impact communities in different ways due to structural inequality.
Oh yeah, yeah, there's a huge parallel there, absolutely. We have a pandemic now that's a problem for everyone, but it is a frightful thing in communities of color around the country and lower income communities. They're being hit by they're taking the brunt of it and the brunt of the cleanup, just like during 9/11. You're right. It was people who really had no choice but to go back in and start to sort things out, literally taking brooms and dustpans and cleaning up in a lot of cases. I remember walking by buildings down there where literally all the windows are all blown out. Somebody had to repair those. And those are working people who are, you know, breathing toxic dust all the time anyway. And now they're down there doing this. Just parenthetically, I mean, it's worth noting that 9/11 health-wise was not just a New York City problem. I mean, this was the World Trade Center down in Lower Manhattan. People from all over the greater New York area, from three states, were working in that place and were affected by it. I mean, it was the actual footprint of the problem was geographically was very large. And it's the same thing here. You know, with the pandemic, we've got a problem that's literally global. There is a tendency by the state, when something like this happens, to think small, to think that This is a problem just for us. It's just a problem right here, or it's a problem over there, and it can be contained, or it is contained. And that was the thinking during 9/11 too. It was some of the most outraged people about the situation, the health situation in Lower Manhattan, were families in New Jersey. But nobody was really thinking about that in New York City. With a pandemic, it's kind of the same thing in a way. You can't, so your infection rate is lower in such and such part of the United States right now. Okay, well, you know, gee, we don't have to take precautions. Well, no, nobody's isolated from this thing. You can't think of it compartmentally that way. Mm-hmm. And that's a big parallel too. It points up one of the problems with the state system we have, I think, is that there's this tendency to sort of parochialize your thinking, even in the face of something that's obviously a massive event. So there's that. And then, you know, there's also just with getting back to the WEF itself, there's this tendency of people on top to think of it as a PR problem. You know, the whole point of bringing the WEF to New York was to say, we're open for business again. Everything's back to normal. Gee, it's 5 months since this terrorist attack happened and this disaster happened in Lower Manhattan. But, you know, we're New York strong. We're back in business and all that kind of thing. That was not the way the city was thinking. And we were still in an emergency situation. I mean, there was literally a dust cloud over that part of Manhattan that the city was trying its damnedest to get us to all ignore. I mean, it was literally a physical thing that was still there. In the case of the pandemic, same thing. The reason we're in a second wave or a third wave now with the pandemic is because governments were so eager to declare the thing over in March or April and just sort of pretend that we can get back to normal now. And that's basically their tendency when these things happen is to open for business again as soon as possible. And that's just the capitalist nature of the system is, oh my God, we're losing money. You know, we have to start, everybody has to get back in the office, you know, or the factory floor or whatever, or back in their Uber car. So that's again, the problem is this attempt to sort of declare the problem over and get it out of the way.
Thank you, Eric, for sharing all that. Thinking about policy, extending on this critique that you're outlining of sort of the short-term nature of political policy on the part of both the mainstream Democratic Party and, of course, the Republican Party or whatever you want to call it.
The party of Trump, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think we see sort of similar short-term thinking here in Canada with, right. You know, optics from the Liberal Party of Justin Trudeau that appear progressive globally, but don't really address a lot of the root issues. But I think I wanted to maybe just highlight a term, and I thought of this in 2016. It was sort of like an alarm going off in my head when Trump was elected about sort of, as it's called, the centrists or liberal class. And the term is shortcuts. And, you know, I'm thinking about that now in terms of what you were reflecting on about 9/11 and the pandemic and sort of the push to just sort of move things on without actually addressing the roots of the crisis in the moment.
Yeah.
And those types of decisions actually elongating or perpetuating the crisis because the points of issue aren't being reflected on or acted upon in a long-term way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, around Trump's election in 2016, a lot of those long-term injustices and structural inequalities that were part, not the only element of Trump being elected, but a part of the reason that some working people did vote for him. Of course, the adoption of racism was also part of that, yep. that populist racist right media had perpetuated. All of this to say that as the new Biden administration's coming in, and we're talking, Eric, one day after the inauguration, I think there's this idea of going back to normal, or quote unquote, and of course this affects the whole world. But, you know, I think about militarism, and I think about our conversation about the World Economic Forum and the consequences, right? Like, for example, the targeted assassination in violation of international law of Soleimani in Iran, for example. Like, yes. The idea that an event like this will just go away, you know, because a democratic mainstream administration came into play. We saw with 9/11 that events have consequences, historical events. You know, the Afghanistan situation dates back, I mean, historically to colonialism, but in a more recent sense to 1979 and the US intervention and the proxy war between the Soviets and the United States. All of this to say that that led to devastating consequences for you as a New Yorker and for many people, right? Sure. This inability to think consequentially about the long-term impacts of policy, militarism, health, economic injustice. Yeah, so any reflections on this?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right to bring up Afghanistan, because that's still a problem. It's still an issue almost 20 years later. It's the same thing with the pandemic. This is not something that that came out of nowhere. We've had a number of close calls with other epidemics that could have been as devastating as this one, and we're likely to have more. And it doesn't seem to me that there is that an ability has been developed to cope with it in a systematic way, either nationally or globally. This is a problem that pandemics are a problem that literally needs global cooperation. There's no institutions to do it. The WHO has no real power. In terms of 9/11. Again, you had this, the response to it. Well, first of all, I mean, in some ways, the cause of it, if you want to really go back to and understand the dynamic, was the insistence on the U.S. of going it alone and controlling any kind of international response to something like a terrorist attack, to something like the threat of Saddam Hussein. Anything like that, the United States has to go it alone, and the world has to just follow and be dragged along by the nose, and you know, all in the service of this sort of U.S. global imperium. That is not questioned. That is not really being questioned by the incoming Biden people, who I was disheartened to say are the same people essentially who served under Obama and were. Absolute dyed-in-the-wool American interventionists. Any problem in the globe, American intervention, that's what's needed to solve it. And there's no real attempt to look at these as global problems that need to be handled in a global context. In other words, the United States might not always get exactly what it wants, you know, in this situation. And it's the same thing with the pandemic. Is the Trump administration, the former Trump administration, I'm happy to say, treated it basically as a situation of, okay, let's develop a vaccine and let's get all the vaccine we can, and we'll take care of ourselves first before anybody else gets any. In spite of the fact that if you leave out sub-Saharan Africa, this is a global economy. This is the global economy they created. Sub-Saharan Africa, you are going to get infected again. I mean, it's going to continue to be a problem. You can't, as I say again, you can't compartmentalize it this way anymore. And so you're absolutely right. There's this tendency to look at it, to look at these problems as something that can be dealt with in the short term, that can be dealt with in a very parochial, narrow kind of way. You know, rather than something that requires a cooperative response, you know, the basic tendency of the United States is to is to kind of apply free market principles to foreign policy or to health policy or to whatever. You know, with the United States being the big capitalist that's going to get its way first. That's the sort of the basic problem, I think.
That was a conversation I had with writer and activist Eric Larson. He's published numerous books, including a really excellent one with Seth Tobachman called Understanding the Crash, looking at the ways that the economic crisis of 2008 affected poor and working people in the U.S. and the reality of the toxic housing loans that were pushed on low-income communities by big banks. I was talking with Eric about the mobilization against the World Economic Forum in winter 2002 in New York City. I thought it was important to revisit this because also the protest was in January, but also because I think that the protest really succeeded in highlighting the intersections between a protest of economic injustice in the world, but also a protest against militarism and the ways that these systems intersect. It is the same structures of power that allow the ongoing global system where some of the world's wealthiest hold the wealth of the bottom 80% of the world. And it is that same system that allows and propels militarization and war as an industry, as a economic model through the military-industrial complex. I really encourage you to check out Eric Larson's work. He's published through AK Press and a number of other excellent independent publishing houses. This has been Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host, Stefan Christophe, and we are with you every Wednesday at 11 a.m. We also have a podcast. You can search us on Apple Podcasts. Just look up Free City Radio. And do stay tuned. The F-Files is coming up next. This is People Powered Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM, also streaming online at www.ckut.ca.
Is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips, and if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement.
Okay, super. How are you today?
I'm very well.
Excellent.
My name is Julia Eckert. I'm German and I live in Brussels. I'm a viola player and also a programmer at QO2 Workspace, also here in Brussels. At the workspace, I'm making, together with my colleagues Carolina and Henry, I'm making the program. We receive the residents, we listen to the residents, and we make research projects from what we hear. As a viola player, I have been classical training. I have done some improvisation also, and since some years now, I am mostly working with composer Elian Radigue, about whom I also made recently a book. Well, I think the interest to sound came via music, because initially, of course, I like to play music. And I think I could even say that I like more to play it than to listen to it. Still today, I do not listen to much music. I guess that step by step, I realized that sound is something that you can ask many questions about, but also something with which you can ask many questions. It's also like a means of research.